He slams the door, but I can still hear him urinating, then flushing, then running water. A long minute later, he emerges, wearing workout clothes. The neck of his t-shirt is wet, along with his hairline, and I can tell that he's just splashed water on his reddened face. He looks at me for several long seconds, holding on to the bedpost, then says, "I asked you to marry me because I loved you," his voice low and calm but unsteady, "not because Daniel died." "Okay," I say, nodding. "I'm sorry. I didn't want to upset you." "Well, that strategy isn't working," he says, dropping his hand to his side. At first, I think he's referring to how upset he is currently, but then he clarifies. "You don't say yes to a marriage proposal because you think saying no will upset someone." I try to interrupt him, but he continues. "And you don't say yes because you happen to share a tragic story with someone either. In fact, most people who share a tragic story end up splitting. Look at your parents." "I know, Nolan. I'm really sorry. I just thought I should tell you. I thought you should know." "Okay, Meredith. Well, now I know," he says. "So what am I supposed to do with this information? More than 7 years later. What do you want?"
"I want Daniel back," I finish, suddenly hating myself more than Nolan ever could.
He throws up his hands in utter disgust.
"Well, we can't have that, Meredith. So short of a resurrection or going back to 2001 in a time machine, what do you want?"
"I want to figure this out," I say as meekly as I've ever said anything.
"How?"
he shouts.
"I don't know," I say, wincing. "Please stop yelling at me."
He blows into his hands, as if he's warming them on a cold day, before turning, walking over to an ottoman, and sitting down to put on his socks and running shoes.
"Where are you going?"
I ask.
"For a run."
"May I come?" He looks up at me.
"Because you want to come, or because you think you should come," he says, his eyes narrowing and flashing. "Or because you think I want you to come?"
"Because I want to," I say, but I hear my voice rising in an unconvincing question. Nolan hears it too, because he stands, shakes his head, and says,
"Actually, Meredith, I think I want to be alone for a while."
Chapter 17, Josie. After our second date/non-date, Pete and I text and talk daily, sometimes more than once. During one flirtatious late-night exchange, in which he jokingly offers his services to impregnate me the old-fashioned way, it flits through my mind that there might be romantic potential between us. But for the most part, our interaction remains platonic, and I stay focused on my goal, determined not to lose more precious time, waffling and stalling, looking for excuses not to go through with my plan, whether using Pete's sperm or an anonymous donor. At certain moments, the whole process reminds me of adopting Revis. First, I had to decide that I truly wanted a dog, any dog, and that the pros outweighed the many cons. Then I had to choose my actual dog. For months, I tirelessly researched breeds and breeders, while also pulling up images of homeless pups on various pet finder websites. I drove all over Georgia, visiting shelters, and I frequented the Humane Society on Howell Mill Road, to such an extent that I became a de facto volunteer. Eventually, I ruled out a purebred, feeling compelled to rescue, and then eliminated all puppies after discovering that they have a much easier time finding homes than adult dogs. But I still remained paralyzed by indecision, reluctance, and endless second-guessing, always focusing on the particular drawbacks of individual dogs. Some barked too much, others shed excessively. Many simply had a notoriously aggressive breed in their mix, like Pitbull or Rottweiler, I hated to be prejudiced against a breed, but my sister was adamant that I not take the chance with Harper, and ultimately, I agreed with her. Then one day after work, I decided it was time to pull the trigger, so I drove over to the Humane Society, walked into the adult big dog room, always less crowded than the puppy and small dog rooms, and spotted Revis, a new resident, staring adorably up at me from the corner of his cinder block kennel, a 3-year-old black lab collie mix. He was larger than what I ideally wanted, with loads of fluffy black hair that I knew would end up on everything, particularly in my all-white bedroom. 2 strikes. Then I read his story, typed up and posted on his kennel, about how his former owner had dropped him off, unable to deal with Revis's separation anxiety, which I knew was a nice way of saying he destroys shit when left alone. 3 strikes. I almost kept walking, headed for a gnarly-looking but very sweet beagle retriever mix named Betty, also a new resident. But something made me stop and kneel down before Revis. "Come here, boy," I called out softly. "Come here, Revis." Revis gave me a skeptical stare before standing, wagging his fluffy tail, and trotting over to me. He pressed his pink and black mottled nose against the plexiglass partition, staring into my eyes. A moment later, I had retrieved the key to his padlock and was letting him lead me around the courtyard outside the shelter. He was attentive, alert, and good on a leash, and as we sat in the shade quietly bonding, I whispered into one cocked ear, "Hey, buddy, are you my dog?" Revis looked up at me, right into my eyes, and I swear he smiled and nodded. I was smitten. Of course, even then, when I was utterly convinced he was the dog for me, it still took me another 10 days, 2 additional visits, and an introduction between Revis and Gabe, after which Gabe voted an unequivocal no, wary over the separation anxiety description. Before I finally paid my fee, signed the papers, overrode Gabe's veto, and made it official. That was 3 years ago, and despite what a giant pain in the ass Revis can be, I have never once, even fleetingly, questioned my decision to adopt him, rescue him, make him mine. When I draw this comparison to Gabe one evening, he looks up at me from his book.
"You're comparing having a baby to getting a dog?"
"No, I'm comparing Pete to Revis," I say, sitting on the chair across from him. Gabe closes the book, marking his spot with his thumb.
"Look, Josie, don't make me go all Meredith on your ass."
I shift in my chair and give him a sheepish smile. "I just mean I have to make a choice. I have to just do this, and the more I shop around, the more confusing it gets, and maybe I should just go with Pete."
"Shop around?"
he interjects, tossing his book onto the coffee table.
"Do you know how that sounds?
Shop, look, research, it's all the same thing," I say. "It's just like Pet Finder or Match. No matter how you try to sugarcoat it, I'm shopping for sperm, just like people shop for pets or spouses." Gabe nods, surrendering the point in a way that makes me feel jubilant. But then he says,
"Okay, maybe so, but I still think this Pete thing is a terrible idea at best."
"And at worst?"
"A really, really terrible idea."
"See that?" I say with a smirk. "You thought Revis was a really, really terrible idea, too." Lying on the floor between us, Revis hears his name and glances over at me without lifting his head.
"He was a terrible idea,"
Gabe says, pointing at the leg of the coffee table that Revis recently gnawed during a thunderstorm. Gabe tried to sand it down and camouflage it with a brown Sharpie, but the shades of brown don't match. "But you love him," I say. Gabe raises his brows at Revis, then shakes his head, having learned not to be sidetracked by my meandering debating style.
"Okay, but are you really comparing the father of your child to a mutt you rescued from the Humane Society?"
I stare back at him, a stubborn standoff ensuing. Several seconds later, after Gabe blinks first, I say, "Would you at least meet him? Tomorrow night, I invited him over for dinner."
"Are you just trying to get me to cook?"
he says, narrowing his eyes. "Maybe," I say, "but we could also order a pizza."
"I have plans with Leslie,"
he says. "She can meet him, too."
"So now you're taking a poll?"
No, I'm not taking a poll. I don't care what Leslie thinks, I say, already tired of hearing her name, at least the way he says it, so reverently. I want your opinion as my best friend. He folds his arms across his chest and takes a deep breath, but I can tell I've reeled him in with this last line.
Is Pete aware that he's being interviewed?
Interviewed? No, because he's not. Is he aware that I want him to meet my best friend? Yes, he is, and he wants to meet you too.
Why? Because he likes you, or because he's seriously considering donating his sperm to you?
Are they mutually exclusive?
They should be.
Okay, the latter then, I say. In fact, this whole thing was actually his idea.
It's called wanting to sleep with you, ding-a-ling.
No, I say. It's not like that. We wouldn't have sex. We'd go through the proper channels. We have another staring contest, and this time Gabe wins.
So if he randomly donated to a sperm bank, you're telling me that his jizz would be your first choice?
Please don't call it jizz, I say, cringing.
Okay, his seed. His sacred seed.
Yes, it might be, actually. Hence, the reason I want you to meet him.
You read the essays, so what's the difference? There's a big difference, Gabe says. But okay, I'll screen this dude for you.
The following night, Leslie and Pete arrive at the same time and are introducing themselves as I open the door. They are both dressed casually in jeans and t-shirts, though Leslie has on crazy high sandals and her hair looks suspiciously blown out. Hey, come in, I say, feeling genuinely happy to see Pete and only a little annoyed to see Leslie. Pete gives me a slight grin, followed by a friendly one-armed hug.
Thanks for the invite.
Yes, thank you, Leslie says, handing me a bottle of red wine with a funky Andy Warhol-esque label. This'll go with pizza, right? Gabe says we're having pizza. Yes, we are, I say.
And yes, anything goes with pizza.
I smile, and she smiles back at me, but there is something about her expression that seems insincere. It's almost as if she thinks she's doing me a favor by hanging out tonight, which I guess, in a sense, she is, but I don't think she's earned the right to feel that way. Still in a trial period herself. Your hair looks great, Leslie, I say as Gabe walks into the foyer behind me. Thanks, she replies so flatly that I decide to call her out in front of her new beau. Did you get a blowout? I ask casually. The question catches her off guard, and she hesitates before mumbling yes. She just didn't feel like doing it herself, so stopped in at Dry Bar. Feeling a tad guilty for breaking at least a footnote of the girl loyalty code, I smile and say, Oh, yeah, it's such a pain to do it in this humidity. She murmurs her agreement, then looks past me, her face lighting up as Gabe steps forward to kiss her on the lips, making that gross, food sound, like the one Aiden used to make on Sex and the City every time he kissed Carrie. As their faces separate and he slips his arm around her waist, I make a mental note to tell him never to make that noise again unless he's eating insanely good chocolate cake. And maybe not even then. Pete, this is Gabe, my best friend in the world, I say as much for Leslie's benefit as Pete's. They shake hands as I continue my introduction. And Gabe, this is Pete. I pause, then add, my newest friend and potential sperm donor. Everyone stares at me with identical expressions of surprise, which I take secret delight in.
She's all about shock value, Gabe says to Pete. I can see that,
Pete says with a laugh as Gabe turns, now taking Leslie's hand and leading us into the kitchen, where he's prepared a simple spread of blue tortilla chips and homemade guacamole.
Margaritas, anyone?
He asks. We all say yes.
Salt?
Pete and I say yes, and Leslie says no, which I find a bit predictable and irritating. We watch as Gabe artfully runs a lime wedge over the rims of three glasses. He then presses them into a coaster of coarse sea salt and pours four glasses from a pitcher with bartender precision.
Help yourselves, he says with a flourish.
We each take a glass, murmuring our thanks, as I warn Pete and Leslie of the potency of Gabe's recipe.
They're pretty much straight tequila, I say, with a little lime juice.
Gabe winks, which I've only seen him do about twice before, then lifts his own glass eye level, his face somber as he delivers an unexpected toast. Gabe gives toasts about as often as he winks.
"To new relationships," he says, "and all that they may hold in store."
We clink our glasses together as I roll my eyes. Gabe gives me a sheepish shrug.
"So," he says, turning to Pete, "Josie says you're from Wisconsin?"
Pete nods, easy small talk ensuing about the Midwest, specifically camping and skiing, two passions they share. This in turn leads to a conversation about college, work, even politics. Gabe and Pete are both self-proclaimed libertarians. Leslie and I interject along the way while I make a point to ask her polite sidebar questions, but I try to let Pete and Gabe bond as much as possible. By the time we finish our margaritas, I can tell they genuinely like each other. At least I can tell Gabe likes Pete, which is what really matters here. "You two are a lot alike," I remark not so subtly during one lull. "I knew you'd hit it off." They both nod and smile, and Gabe says,
"Awkward."
"It's not awkward," I say. "I'm just happy you like each other. That's all."
"If you're happy, we're happy. Right, Pete?" Gabe says. "Oh, she's one of those?" Pete asks, his brows raised. "If she ain't happy, nobody's happy?" "Oh, yeah," Gabe says, nodding. "She's totally one of those."
"No, I'm not," I protest, even though I know I kind of am. At this point, I catch Leslie giving me a critical once-over. Maybe it's in my head, but I have the feeling that it's hard for her when I'm the center of attention, at least Gabe's attention. And I suddenly feel just a tad self-conscious, so I change the subject, open our junk drawer, pull out a deck of cards, and give it a shuffle. "Y'all want to play hearts?" I ask, looking up at Pete first.
"Sure," he says, "but I should warn you, I'm really good."
"Counting cards shoot the moon good?" I ask him.
"Yes,"
he says, holding my gaze,
"that good."
He then turns to Gabe and says,
"She just wants to test my intelligence. The other night, she actually quizzed me at the dinner table. With brain teasers."
"Well," I say, "I want a smart kid."
"Yeah," Gabe says. "She wants to raise the gene pool."
"I resemble that," I say, an old joke between us. Gabe chuckles and says,
"Yeah, I know. That's the problem. You do resemble that."
I punch him, then turn to ask Leslie if she plays cards.
"Other than Uno?"
She hesitates, folding her arms across her flat chest, then says, "A little, but I've never played hearts."
"We can teach you," I say.
"If you want," Leslie says, glancing at Gabe as if transmitting a private message.
"Nah, I'm not in the mood for cards. Let's just talk,"
he says, deftly interpreting her look to mean that she's not in the mood for cards.
"Okay,"
I say with a shrug.
"It was just a suggestion."
Gabe clears his throat and says,
"Maybe we should order the pizza now."
"Sure," I say, grabbing my phone. "I'll call Blue Moon. What does everyone like? Sausage and mushroom?" I look at Pete, fondly remembering the flatbread from our first date.
"Sounds good to me,"
he says.
"Leslie's a vegetarian," Gabe says.
"You are, huh?" I say, giving her a closed-lipped smile.
"Yes,"
she says, raising her chin a few centimeters.
"Here we go,"
I think, then toss her a softball she can hit from her soapbox. "Because of health or animal rights?"
"Both,"
she says.
"Hmm, then do I have the sperm donor for you,"
I say, thinking of Glenn S., the animal rights activist, "if you ever end up needing one." She smiles her smug 20-something smile, then says, "Thanks, but hopefully that won't be necessary." Later that night, after our two pizzas arrive, one sausage and mushroom, the other gluten-free veggie, and Gabe, Pete, and I all eat three slices, and Leslie eats one, minus the crust, I find myself wondering what my beef with her is, vegetarian pun intended. Am I just jealous of her fresh, unlined face and raging fertility? Or feeling territorial over Gabe, selfishly clinging to our status quo, wanting to keep my best friend all to myself, especially as I embark on an overwhelming downright scary endeavor? As the evening wears on, I have the feeling it has more to do with Leslie herself, something I can't quite pinpoint, but that I just don't like about her. It's nothing she says or does. It's more what she doesn't say or do. She answers all my questions to her, whether how many siblings she has, one sister, or where she studied undergrad, Tufts, or where she grew up, Alexandria, Virginia. But she never asks a single question of her own. Instead, she just sits there, emitting her smug, artsy vibe. To be fair, maybe Gabe's already told her all about me, but I don't think that lets her entirely off the hook.
So, Gabe says at one point after I make another reference to sperm donors, are you two really serious about this thing?
I look at Pete, and he looks at me, then smiles. I smile back at him and say, I am.
I am too, Pete says, but it's up to Josie. I'm sure she can find better.
My smile grows wider, thinking that his response is generous but humble.
So how would this work? Gabe asks. I mean, not mechanically speaking. But, you know, how would the whole thing work?
We haven't really gotten that far, Pete replies.
But that would be up to Josie, too. So everything's up to Josie?
Gabe asks with a measure of skepticism, suddenly sounding like a father interviewing a new boyfriend. I hold my breath, awaiting Pete's reply, realizing how much I want him to pass the test.
I'm not going to say everything's up to her, he says.
Gabe raises an eyebrow, and I half expect him to exclaim,
aha!
But instead, he waits as Pete crosses his legs, looking contemplative, then continues.
I guess what I'm saying is, I'm not offering her everything. Just my sperm.
He lets out a nervous laugh. Gabe doesn't smile back, but I can't tell if he's disapproving or just worried.
So not financial support, for example.
Correct, Pete says,
though I might help out here and there. I really don't know. We haven't figured the whole thing out. But it wouldn't be traditional. I wouldn't be the baby's father.
You wouldn't?
Gabe says.
I mean, I would be the biological father, but not the father-father.
So what if she got pregnant, then never wanted to see you again?
We talked about that.
And?
And I'd understand.
Gabe stares at him for a few seconds, then says,
so what's in it for you?
Does something have to be in it for me?
I guess not, Gabe shrugs, but people usually act in their self-interest.
Yes, but not always. Don't you give blood?
Blood and sperm are kind of different, don't you think?
Gabe asks. I interject, feeling defensive of Pete. Gabe, you argued the opposite just a few weeks ago. You compared this to organ donation, remember?
Yeah,
Gabe fires back.
And you said it wasn't the same at all, remember?
I start to answer, and he keeps going.
Besides, this isn't about what I think. It's about what Pete thinks. I'm trying to understand how he feels.
Gabe swallows, still looking tense as he turns back to Pete.
So describe your ideal scenario.
My ideal scenario, Pete starts, then stops. Let's see. My ideal scenario. You're putting him on the spot, I say, half expecting Pete to get up and walk out. Why should he put up with an interrogation? Pete shakes his head and says, no, he's fine. I'm just thinking. He tries again.
My ideal scenario is that I donate my sperm and Josie gets pregnant and then gives birth to a beautiful, healthy baby, her child. But what?
Gabe says, pouncing.
But maybe she'd allow me to be involved in some limited way.
Define limited, Gabe says.
I don't know, a once-a-year outing? Maybe an annual Braves game?
You're a Braves fan? Gabe asks, as if this is pertinent.
No, Brewers. But since I'm assuming road trips are out of the question, I'd settle for the Braves.
Pete smiles.
And what if you took your kid to that Braves game and got attached?
Gabe fires back.
I'm sure I probably would,
Pete says.
And? You don't see that as a problem?
Gabe, I say finally, getting a little angry. Why are you trying to talk him out of helping me?
I'm not,
he snaps back. It's fine,
Pete says calmly. It's actually helpful. Go on.
Okay,
Gabe says, nodding, then taking a deep breath.
Well, I did a little research.
I shoot him a pointed look, wondering why he didn't tell me about his research first.
And even if you have a legal document in place, courts can sometimes overturn them, which means...
He pauses dramatically.
There's a possibility that Josie could sue you for child support.
Gabe points to me, but continues to stare at Pete.
And there's a chance you could sue her for paternity. Even joint custody.
He gives me a hard look now.
I wouldn't do that, I say, borderline pissed now.
Neither would I, Pete says. But you both could, Gabe says. It happens. It's a risk. Not if we used a licensed doctor, Pete retorts. In those cases, agreements are almost always upheld.
I look at him surprised, as he gives me a slight but adorable smile.
I did some research, too.
I smile back at him, touched.
You did?
I did,
he says, nodding. For a few seconds, I forget that Gabe and Leslie are in the room, until Gabe clears his throat and begins his closing argument.
Look, guys, he says, I have to be honest here. I just don't think this is a good idea. At all.
Well, I do,
Leslie suddenly chimes in, completely unexpectedly. Everyone stares at her as she continues.
Josie wants a baby, and Pete wants to help her. So why not?
Her words are nice enough, but her body language, tone, and entire demeanor are loaded. She shifts on the sofa, drops her head to Gabe's shoulder, then yawns wearily, clearly ready for this portion of the evening to end. Pete ignores her, directing his reply to Gabe.
We obviously have to give it some more thought. There's a lot to discuss, and we'd have to talk to professionals in this field. A doctor and probably a lawyer.
His voice is steady, strong, reasonable.
Most likely I think I would donate then disappear. That would probably be best for everyone involved.
I feel a wave of disappointment before he adds a but. I wait, feeling hopeful, though not sure what for.
But Josie and I can make our own rules,
he says, meeting my eyes with a tenderness that makes me catch my breath.
Right, Josie?
Right, Pete,
I say with a big smile, feeling almost as lucky as a girl in love. The following morning, while I'm still in bed scrolling through my Instagram, Gabe returns home from Leslie's and knocks on my door. Come in, I say, putting my phone down and sitting up. He opens the door, looking disheveled and tired, but extremely animated.
It's a terrible, horrible, no-good, very bad idea,
he says, referencing my favorite children's book, which I keep on my nightstand, along with Harold and the Purple Crayon and the Five Chinese Brothers. I play dumb and calmly reply, What is?
This thing with Pete. It's a complete and utter disaster waiting to happen.
He glances around my room, looking suspicious, then says,
Did he spend the night?
No,
I say, sounding aghast. Of course not.
Uh-huh.
He says, crossing his arms.
He didn't, I say. God, what's your deal?
It's a disaster,
he says again. You don't like him? I say.
I like him just fine,
he says, sitting on the foot of my bed.
But this is truly one of your all-time worst ideas.
Why do you say that? I ask.
Because it is,
he says, then starts to enumerate all the things that could go wrong. Several rehashed from last night. He could get too attached and sue for partial custody. My husband could resent him. His wife could despise me. I could end up with my kids' half-siblings living in town. I finally interrupt him during a completely far-fetched hypothetical about my daughter being torn over who should give her away at her wedding.
She can't decide between her sperm donor father and the man you married.
But I'm not even married, and you're already marrying my daughter off, I say.
And then, before he can get started again, I add, There are always risks in relationships. Look at you and Leslie. You could have knocked her up last night. Then what?
First of all, I actually couldn't have knocked her up last night, because we didn't have sex.
Yeah, right, I say, thinking of that gross, sound he made when he kissed her.
You guys never stopped touching each other all evening.
Well, if you must know, we got in our first fight last night.
I'm sorry to hear that, I say, resisting the urge to ask him about it. Then I say, but at some point you could end up getting her pregnant, or just marrying her and then realizing that she completely sucks. I say the last word with as much fire as I can muster.
That's totally different,
he says as I notice dark circles under his eyes and a massive underground zit emerging on his forehead.
And you know it.
Well, every situation is different, I say.
Yes, he says, and this one is way, way too messy and complicated and fraught with dangers and pitfalls. If I got just one veto in your life, this would be it.
I picture Leslie's uppity little nose, then ask if I get a veto in his life, too.
And you know what the biggest problem here is?
He asks, ignoring my question.
In a sea of really big problems?
What? I ask at my own peril.
Dude likes you.
I stare at him confused, and he clarifies.
Pete.
I know who Dude is, I say, but I don't get your point. Of course he likes me. He wouldn't do this for me if he didn't like me. Gabe shakes his head.
No, he likes you. As more than a friend. As more than a, hey, let me loan you some sperm. He wants to sleep with you, date you, maybe marry you.
You're nuts, I say, laughing and throwing a pillow at his face. No, he does not. He lofts the pillow into the air, and we both watch as it falls neatly in place.
I'm a guy,
he says with calm certainty.
I can tell. I know, and I promise you, this would be an absolute fucking disaster, as in the biggest disaster you've ever put in motion. And that's saying a lot.
His face falls as soon as the words are out.
You know what I mean,
he says, looking guilty. Yeah, I say, feeling crushed, knowing that we both know that there will always be a far worse and much darker disaster in my past.
Chapter 18. Meredith. In true Nolan ignore the issue style, he returns from his run several hours later, after I've cried and showered and dressed and cried some more, and tells me he thinks we should just enjoy the weekend. The coward in me is relieved, but at the same time, I am incredulous, frustrated, and worried that nothing is going to change. In my heart, our marriage, my life. And that feeling grows larger when, that evening, we exchange anniversary cards, have another long romantic dinner, and then return to our room, where I reluctantly initiate guilt-driven but resentment-filled sex. While it's actually happening, I make my mind as blank as possible, which in turn makes me realize just how much of sex is mental. In other words, it's virtually impossible to make it a purely physical act. It's always more than that. Afterward, Nolan curls his body around mine and says, You couldn't tell? I murmur. Just confirming, he whispers. Yeah, I say. I did. Good, he says, tightening his embrace. His arms are strong, warm, comforting. And the feeling that washes over me is a complete contradiction to everything I told him this morning. I kiss the side of his elbow, the only thing I can reach, and say, I'm sorry, Nolan, for earlier. Then as I get ready to backpedal, he shushes me and says, Let's just go to sleep, Mare. I close my eyes, deciding that for now, I'd rather doubt myself than doubt my marriage. The following morning, right after breakfast, we drive back to Atlanta, heading straight to my mother's house to collect Harper. It's been less than 48 hours since we dropped her off, but it feels like much longer. And I can tell Nolan misses her as much as I do, both of us practically running into the house. He gets to her first, picking her up out of her chair to give her a big hug. I have her beside them, waiting for my turn as I inhale her strawberry lip smacker scent. But before I can hug her, she scrambles back down to the table, returning to her elaborate art project incorporating crayons, rubber cement, tape, and paste, because you can never have too many adhesives, and copious amounts of purple glitter. I want a hug and a kiss, too, I say, stooping down to her eye level. She turns her head a few degrees and gives me a perfunctory kiss on the cheek. How about a hug? She shakes her head and says,
Later, Mommy. I'm very busy now.
They are clearly words she's heard many times before, and I feel a stab of guilt knowing she is quoting me. What are you making? I ask, sitting at the table beside her, and wondering why my mother didn't put down a drop cloth or newspaper, glitter already working its way into the crevices of her rustic wooden table. I resist the urge to clean, waiting for her answer.
A castle, and that's you, she says,
pointing to an oval-faced brunette peering out of a half-moon third-floor window. I'm not quite frowning, but certainly not smiling. My mouth a straight, smudged line of red crayon. What's Mommy doing up there? Nolan asks, sitting on the other side of Harper.
Just looking out, Harper says, at this tree and this bluebird.
She points to each as I notice that her fingers are beginning to lose their chubbiness, becoming little girl slender. Nolan and I exchange a glance, and I wonder if he's trying to psychoanalyze her art project as much as I am. And where are you? I ask, even though it is clearly her standing in the front yard wearing a pink A-line frock. Beside her is a strapping, smiling man that has to be Nolan.
Right here, she says, pointing to herself. With Daddy.
That's a mighty happy pair, I say under my breath. But Harper hears me and quotes me back.
A happy pair, she says, smiling, nodding.
So, did you and Nana have fun? I ask, changing the subject.
Yeah,
she says. You mean yes, I say, gently correcting her.
Yes,
she says, shaking more purple glitter into the flower bed in front of the castle. We had a marvelous time, Mom says, gazing at Harper adoringly. And how was your anniversary weekend? It was great, I say, forcing a cheerful tone. Very relaxing. It's such a beautiful place. Nolan quickly echoes my comments. Mom looks pleased. I'm so glad you had a good time, she says. So what else did you two do? I ask, glancing from Mom to Harper. Let's see, we watched movies, right, Harper? Harper nods and says,
Lady and the Tramp, and 101 Dalmatians, and Lassie Come Home.
Oh, a little dog theme, I see, Nolan says pointedly, glancing my way. In addition to his second child, he has been trying to get Harper a puppy for months now, but I have held out, knowing that I will be the one taking it out every morning, feeding it, and scooping up its poop from the yard. And speaking of dogs, Mom says, Aunt Josie came over with Revis for a late breakfast. You actually just missed her. Drats, I say, my voice completely flat. Mom says my name is a warning. What? I ask, feigning innocence. Be nice, she says. And then, have you still not talked to her? No, I say, positive that this fact was discussed, and knowing how adept Josie is at making me out to be the bad guy. You really need to talk to her. And why's that? I know her answer before she says it. Because she's your sister. She clears her throat, then adds, And because she's going to have this baby, and we need to support her decision. Do you think she'll really go through with it? Nolan asks. Mom nods and says, Yes, in fact, she's picked her donor. I flinch, but remain silent, determined not to ask any questions and indirectly validate what Josie's doing. Of course, Nolan doesn't get this nuance and eagerly asks for the scoop. Mom takes a deep breath, then starts rattling off the detailed bio of a complete stranger. His name is Peter. He's from the Midwest. Wisconsin, I think she said. But he currently lives in Atlanta. He's 41. I think she said he's 5'10 or 5'11. He has brown hair and hazel eyes. She takes a deep breath, Nolan looking rapt while I pretend to be completely disinterested. And let's see, he's Irish and German by descent. He was raised Catholic but isn't very religious. He is spiritual, though. He believes in God. He likes outdoorsy things, camping and biking and skiing. He's very fit, very healthy. He went to college, then got a graduate degree in physical therapy, which he practices now. He's very smart, especially in math and science. If he does say so himself, I say. Mom ignores my snide comment and says, "Oh," and she says he has a cleft in his chin, which Josie has always liked. "Well, super," I say. "Meredith," she says sternly, "you really need to change your attitude." "Why?" "She never changes her attitude," I say, knowing how immature I sound. "She never resists a single impulse." "Actually," Mom says, her voice gentle, "that's not true. She's really trying lately." I cross my arms and raise my eyebrows. "Oh? How so?" "Well, for one, she has agreed to go to New York with us, in December." "We'll see about that. I bet you $100 she backs out," I say, thinking that's one of Josie's signature tactics. Bow to pressure, then come up with an excuse later. Mom shakes her head. "No, she's really come around on the idea." She says so earnestly that it breaks my heart. "And I think it will be good for her. For all of us, but maybe especially for her." "Why's that?" "She needs to face her grief," Mom says. "She never really has. I think seeing Sophie might help with that. So anyway, we should all probably book our tickets and hotel room. New York is so busy around the holidays." Her voice trails off and her eyes grow glassy, as she is obviously thinking about Daniel. That time of year, trees and decorations and Christmas carols, all completely synonymous with death in our family. I look away, watching Harper add another large tree to the castle grounds, this one an evergreen. Nobody speaks for a long stretch, the only sounds those of Harper's crayon pressing against the paper, and Nolan tapping the table with his thumbs. Annoyed by the monotonous rhythm, I reach over and put my hand on his, silencing him. He glares at me, then clears his throat. "Speaking of New York," he says, "Meredith might go up there sooner than December." I look at him confused. Ellen and I have recently discussed going to the city for a girls' weekend, but I don't recall mentioning this to him, probably because I knew it was a long shot, given my workload at the firm. "Oh?" Mom says, glancing at me. "For work?" "No," Nolan quickly replies. "She just needs a break. A little getaway." "Wasn't that the point of this weekend?" Mom asks, clearly as confused as I am. "Oh, she needs a longer break than that," he says. "A real break. From her job, and Harper, and me." He flashes a fake smile and forces a chuckle. "Don't you think that would be good for her?" Mom nods, but remains pensive. "Well, I guess time away can be good for all of us." "How long of a break do you need, sweetie?" "I don't need a break," I say, feeling both agitated and defensive. Nolan musses my hair, feigning lightheartedness, and says, "Oh, yeah, you do. A couple weeks will do you good." "A couple of weeks?" Mom and I reply in unison. "What about Harper?" she asks as I glare at my husband. "Oh, I have that covered. Hell, Josie's going to be a single parent. Surely I can handle a couple of weeks on my own," he says as I stare at him, wondering when all of this came to him. On his run yesterday? Last night after we had sex? On the virtually silent drive back this morning? He whistles a few bars of an unrecognizable song, then says, "Maybe I'll take some time off, too. Do a little father-daughter bonding. Wouldn't that be fun, Harper?"
"Uh-huh,"
she says, without looking up. "And I'm sure Nana can help a little. And Gran and Pop," he says, referring to his parents. "And Josie, of course. Good old Aunt Josie." Mom frowns, looking confused by the contradiction between his maniacal mood and the undertones of his message. Deep lines appear on her forehead as she asks her standard question. "Should I be worried here?" "No," I say. "Oh, no," Nolan says. "Not one bit. Meredith just needs to do some thinking. Right, Mare?" I bite my lip and mumble a noncommittal yeah, as Mom asks what sort of thinking. "Deep thinking," he chirps. "Soul-searching." "About?" Mom asks. At this point, I'm in damage control mode, so I simply say, "About my job." "So you're seriously thinking about leaving?" she asks, her frown lines easing a bit. I start to reply with a watered-down statement about feeling burned out, but Nolan once again answers for me. "Yes," he says decisively, a word he almost never uses, which is why Harper continues to say yeah and uh-huh. Then he turns and looks into my eyes. "She's seriously thinking about leaving." "What the hell was that about?" I ask Nolan, as soon as we're back at the house and alone as you can be with Harper in the next room. My voice is measured and low, but inside I'm enraged. "What?" he says with a passive-aggressive shrug. "I think it's a great idea. You need some time to think." "Any reason you didn't mention this idea to me first?" I ask, using my fingernail to scrape a piece of hardened shredded wheat from a cereal bowl Nolan left in the sink 2 mornings ago. It's now as hard as superglue. I finally give up and put it in the dishwasher. "Any reason you didn't mention that you think our marriage is a joke?" he asks. "I never said that, nor do I think that." "Okay. Any reason you didn't mention that you think our marriage was a big mistake?" "I didn't say that either, Nolan," I say, spinning around and staring at him. He stares back at me with defiance and disdain. "What did you say, then?" "I don't know, Nolan. I'm just confused." "Well, as I said, I think you need to go away and figure it out." "I can't just go away, Nolan," I say, my hands on my hips. "What about Harper?" "I told you. I can handle things here." I look at him, thinking that he doesn't have the first clue about how to run the washing machine, let alone handle the myriad details of Harper's daily routine. I think about the last time I went on a work trip, and how he didn't even get the mail for 3 days. "What about my job? Can you handle my job, too?" I say. He shrugs. "Take a leave of absence. People do it all the time. Or just quit. You hate it. What's the point of doing something you hate?" "I don't hate it," I say, thinking that his oversimplification of everything is part of the problem. "Yes, you do," he says. "You despise it. You wish you had stayed in New York and become a famous actress." I open my mouth to correct him, as I never desired fame. I just wanted to be a working stage actress. At most, I dreamed about a Tony. And how many Tony Award-winning actresses are household names. But this seems rather beside the point. "Instead, you're an attorney in Atlanta, married to me. Huge, huge mistake," he says. "Nolan," I say, my voice beginning to rise. "Would you please stop this crap? I didn't say that." "Oh, but you think it," he says. "Don't you?" My mind races for a response, as I realize that he is partially right, and maybe, but for Harper, completely right. "And you know what?" he continues. "There's nothing stopping you from getting a do-over." I pretend we're both talking about my job and not a divorce, wondering how long it will be before one of us utters the word aloud. I'm too old to change careers, I say. No, you're not, he says. Isn't acting like riding a bike? Surely it's all still there. Just go to some auditions. I swallow, a huge lump in my throat. It's not that easy, I say. And besides, we can't leave Atlanta. Yes, you can, he says. You can do anything you want to do, Meredith. I turn away from him, looking out the window over the kitchen sink, just like in Harper's drawing, and I feel myself tremble with the tantalizing, terrifying thought that he might be right.
Chapter 19, Josie. On Monday morning, I take a giant leap forward and call the office of Dr. Susan Lazarus. According to my research, Dr. Lazarus is the leading fertility specialist in Atlanta, known for both in vitro fertilization and intrauterine insemination. My heart sinks when her receptionist briskly informs me that her first available appointment is nearly 2 months away. I tell her that I'll take it, then ask if she can please put me on a waiting list. If there's any cancellation, I'll drop everything and come in a moment's notice. I'm pushing 40 and a little bit panicked here.
I feel you, she says with a little chuckle, dropping her professional persona. I turn 40 next week. Ugh.
Do you have kids? I ask.
Yes, 10-month twins, thanks to Dr. Lazarus.
Wow, congrats, I say, feeling bolstered by the anecdote, though the mere thought that I could somehow end up with twins fills me with pure terror. Boys or girls?
One of each, she says.
I congratulate her again as she suddenly informs me that I'm in luck. She just noticed a cancellation on the calendar for this coming Friday at 11, confirming my belief that sometimes small talk can really pay off.
I'll take it, I say.
I give Sydney my entire update at recess that day, the two of us taking our usual supervisory spots on a bench overlooking the playground. As I watch Edie hanging upside down on the monkey bars, her arms dangling, her tiny torso swinging, and her face turning red, I fill Sydney in on Pete, as well as my upcoming appointment with Dr. Lazarus. I'm so proud of you, Josie, she says, turning to give me a sideways hug, and a little jealous.
Hey, why don't you do it with me?
I say excitedly. She laughs.
Matching cars and kids?
I'm serious. Would you ever consider it? I ask as I hear Meredith scoffing in my head, proffering my suggestion as further proof that I'm not taking motherhood seriously. Sydney shakes her head and gives me an adamant, animated hell no. I'm seriously impressed that you're doing this, but personally, if I had to choose just one, I'd rather have a husband than a baby, but definitely in that order. I nod, thinking that although I want both too, the baby part of the equation has always been more important to me, at least since Will and I broke up. And, if I'm honest, I think I might have even felt that way then. I loved him, yes, but he also felt like a prerequisite for motherhood, the means to an end. She gives me a thoughtful look, then says, "Are you scared?" A little, I say, mostly just about logistics. She murmurs her agreement, then asks if I will still live with Gabe or move into my own place. I frown and tell her I haven't figured that out yet, as I hear Meredith's voice again, mumbling that this is par for the course.
Gabe knows your overall plan, though, that you want to have a baby?
I nod and say, of course, Gabe knows everything.
And? She asks. What does he think?
He's supportive, unlike my sister, who is her usual judgmental self. I pause, then say, but he's not really down with the idea of Pete as my donor. Sydney raises her eyebrows.
That's 'cause he's jealous.
Stop it right there, I say, knowing exactly what she's getting at. How many times do I have to tell you men and women can be friends? She smirks.
Yeah, that's what Harry and Sally said. I'm not Sally, I say. Maybe not, but he's definitely Harry, she says. No, he's not, Sid. Didn't I tell you about his new girlfriend? Yeah, yeah, whatever, she says, rolling her eyes. I'm serious. He really likes her. Yeah, but only because he can't have you. I shake my head. No, his objection to Pete is purely a practical one. He thinks I should use an anonymous donor rather than someone I know. He's worried that it would get too weird, messy. And you say? I say I'll take that chance. Pete's smart, attractive, and really sweet. It just feels right. Oh, really now? She says, her voice dripping with innuendo of the sexual kind. The right donor, I say. I have no interest in dating him, either. Well, then, she says, sitting up straighter, introduce us. I laugh and say, not a chance. Why not? He could be my soulmate. You'd deprive me of that? Yes, because that would be too weird, I say, feeling oddly possessive, if not of Pete, then at least of his sperm. That evening, I find Gabe out back, grilling 3 hot dogs while listening to Bob Marley. Hey, I say, leaning against the deck. What's up? He says without looking my way. Is Leslie coming for dinner? He shakes his head. Nope, and she's a vegetarian, remember? Oh, right. How could I forget? I said, only a little snidely. He either misses or ignores my tone and asks if I'm hungry. I threw an extra dog on just in case. Sure, thanks, I say, then ask about his day. Gabe's worked for the same company for nearly a decade, but I'm still not exactly sure what he does for a living. Other than that, it involves graphic design, computers, and a lot of high-maintenance clients. Everyone and everything annoyed me. I laugh and say, so the usual? Pretty much. How about yours? It was okay, I say. I told Sydney about my baby plan and my appointment with Dr. Lazarus on Friday. He nods without looking at me. So what exactly is going to happen on Friday? I shrug and say I'm not sure. It'll probably just be an introduction and a discussion of my options. Is Pete going with you? Gabe asks as he turns down the flame on the grill. No, I say, though the thought did cross my mind earlier today. Why not? He asks. Have you changed your mind about using him? No, I say. He's still kind of at the top of my list, but there's no need for him to go with me, not at this point. I was thinking of asking my mom. It'd be nice to have someone there, you know, for moral support. I give him a needy look, then add, hint, hint. Gabe rolls his eyes and says, you want me to go? I put my hands together in prayer. Would you, please? I guess, he says with a big sigh. You think Leslie will be okay with it? Why wouldn't she? He asks. Because she's controlling and clearly doesn't like me, I almost say, but decide to treat it as a rhetorical question. That'd be really awesome, Gabe, I say. Thank you. No problem, he says with a nonchalant shrug. Besides, I want to be there to hear this doctor tell you that acquaintance sperm is a really shitty idea. Acquaintance sperm? I laugh. Is that a scientific term? Yes. I mean, this Pete guy seems nice and all, but he could be a serial killer with a recessive cystic fibrosis gene for all you know. I laugh. Well, he could be, Gabe says, transferring the hot dogs to a plate, then turning to walk inside. I'm sure Dr. Lazarus will do thorough testing, I say, following him into the house. The old serial killer test, he says, glancing over his shoulder. Well, any sperm donor could be a serial killer, I say. So could any boyfriend for that matter. Hell, for all you know, Leslie could be one. I've never heard of a female serial killer, he says. Well, even if she's not a full-fledged murderer, she could be shady. She could have all kinds of skeletons you know nothing about. I guess, he says,
But the difference is, I'm not planning on impregnating Leslie anytime soon.
Not anytime soon, huh? I say, my hands on my hips.
Stop changing the subject, Gabe says. We're not talking about me. We're talking about you and your capricious choice.